contact us through affiliate relations at gcnlive.com or call 877-807-4048. Call today.
We the people grow cotton, weave fabric, engrave ink, embed strips and fibers to protect from counterfeit, then carting to a private bank, having it lent back at interest, forcing taxes to service debt. This capitalism, or was Jefferson correct when stating a central bank issuing the public currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army? Hi, Ted Anderson. I'm placing a free silver dollar in a book that explains our monetary system. Call for your copy, 800-686-2237. It's time to understand the system. Call 800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.
Through the years of providing water filters to America, you've come to us and we've listened. You asked us to make the water level visible to eliminate the guesswork when refilling the water. We listened. You asked for an elevated base so the system could be used in places beside on the edge of a counter. We listened. You asked us to develop a filter that was made in the USA. We listened. You asked us to include an emergency light for camping and during power outages. We listened. After 9/11, you asked us to develop a filter that was more powerful in removing chemical agents. Again, we listened. Introducing the Berkey Light, the gravity filter requested by America, designed by Americans, and made in America.
Get the Berkey Light, the American water purifier, only to...
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mary Shulman. We're going to be talking about the soy, the use of soy, and, of course, thyroid problems and the part that that actually a soy can create as far as the thyroid and certainly the other problems inherent in thyroid. And so without further ado, Mary, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Why don't you tell us how you got involved in studying soy?
Well, I got involved in looking at the issue of soy as part of my work as a patient advocate for thyroid patients. And I was diagnosed with a thyroid condition back in 1995. I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease, which is the autoimmune disease that causes an underactive thyroid or hypothyroidism. And so it really started me off on kind of a journey to figure out how to get well and feel well again. And so part of my mission to try to learn more about it was looking at all the different factors that could create a risk of thyroid problems, that made thyroid problems worse, things that could help, natural approaches, both pro and con. So I really got involved in talking with a lot of doctors, nutritionists, experts, holistic health folks, and started to hear a lot from people about concerns that people were having regarding soy and the role that soy was playing in developing health problems.
However, why don't you tell us what you had, and is this related specifically to Hashimoto's disease, or is this simply the thyroid in general?
Well, what we know is that overconsumption of soy, particularly soy in the processed kinds of forms, so a lot of the pills and powders and soy shakes and some of the things that we're now seeing a lot of overconsumption of, but when people were eating it in large quantities in its very processed forms, that it starts to act more like a hormone than like a food in some people. And so this hormonal effect, which in very small doses is why people sort of go to soy as a possible help for, you know, menopausal symptoms and things, it, when in large quantities, which is the way that a lot of people started to use soy, it actually could have a hormonal effect that would in some cases interfere with the body's ability to utilize thyroid hormone, and in some people who have a susceptibility to an autoimmune problem, actually appeared to be a trigger factor for bringing on or worsening their autoimmune thyroid condition. So we had two different issues, really. We had it making the thyroid worse for some people, slowing it down, because soy is actually an anti-thyroid goitrogen. It's a goiter-promoting food that actually slows the thyroid down, but also as a as an aggravating factor for the autoimmune component, it seems to also play a role. And then for some people who are simply sensitive or allergic to soy, it acts as a aggravating factor that can also be a trigger for autoimmune disease. So it kind of has a triple whammy effect in some people, and can be, you know, creating some difficulties for people who have a propensity for thyroid problems or who already have a thyroid condition that's been diagnosed.
Well, now, is thyroid deficiency a major factor in our society today?
Well, it actually is, and it's a lot more than we really know. Some doctors that I know and some health experts are estimating that as many as 60 million Americans have a thyroid condition. And the sad part about it is that the vast majority of those people are both undiagnosed and untreated. So that there are a lot of people walking around with an underactive thyroid who don't know that they have this condition, but they do know they have symptoms. So they may be experiencing fatigue, difficulty losing weight or unexpected weight gain. They may have mild depression. They may feel fuzzy-brained, brain-fogged. They may feel cold when other people feel hot. And then, in particular, what some of the symptoms that women particularly suffer, they may have fertility issues.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, this is Mary Shulman, and we're talking to her about the relationship between soy products and thyroid. Now, Mary, we have a new listening audience now for the next 3 minutes, so they didn't hear what you'd said before. And Mary, of course, had gotten interested in the subject of soy products because she was suffering from Hashimoto's disease, which is an autoimmune disease that actually can produce hypothyroidism. And of course, this got her into it. And of course, she's found out that the soy and soy products can not only produce hypothyroidism, but they can also, of course, be responsible for these autoimmune diseases such as she has. And she was just saying how many people in our society have hypothyroidism. And of course, she estimates that some people have said up to 60 million people. Now, that's maybe one in five, one in six people will have an underactive thyroid and will have all sorts of symptoms. Ruffled about that, as they feel cold excessively, they put on weight, they feel foggy, they don't think clearly, they're overweight, they're fatigued. Well, I'm going to let you pick up the story there.
Well, exactly. Great. That's a great recap. And I think some of the other symptoms that we see that are very unique to women in particular are fertility problems. We also see more difficulty with menopause, more difficult PMS. And then for both genders, men and women, low sex drive, low libido, hair loss, and generally just not feeling well. People that are really feeling achy and bloated and overweight, and things slow down. Because when you're hypothyroid, everything slows down. Everything from your thinking to your hair growth to your digestion. So people that really describe themselves as feeling like they're just not moving quickly or thinking quickly, oftentimes that's a good sign that there may be a thyroid condition. So we do have a lot of people out there who are suffering but don't realize that they actually have a diagnosable and treatable condition that's causing these symptoms.
And apparently a lot of people will have heart symptoms referable to the thyroid disease. Would you like to mention that at all? Because I think that even many physicians are unaware of the relationship between the heart and the thyroid.
Yes, actually, we can see a variety of heart-related symptoms. In people who are hypothyroid, we sometimes will see a very slow heartbeat or very low, unusually low blood pressure. But also, paradoxically, a small percentage of people with hypothyroidism will actually have high blood pressure and a high heart rate, which is more typical in hyperthyroidism, the opposite problem where the thyroid is overactive, where people can have atrial fibrillation, they can have erratic heartbeat with erratic rhythms, they can sometimes have very fast pulse and very high blood pressure as well. So, you know, we see some of these heart irregularities on both the hyper and the hypothyroid.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Our guest, of course, is Mary Shimon, and we're talking about the problems with the thyroid, the relationship between hypothyroidism and of course, the heart. And she was just commenting. So some people, you know, of course, ordinarily your heart slows down and if you're hypothyroid, but sometimes you can actually, you can get a tachycardia, a very rapid heart, which was just the opposite from what you might anticipate. But go right ahead with your discussion, Mary.
Yes, the other another common symptom that sort of taps into the whole issue of heart health is also cholesterol. A lot of folks with hypothyroidism will have very high cholesterol and high triglycerides, and in some cases they may even be prescribed medications to help lower that, and the medication doesn't seem to be working. So we call that treatment-resistant high cholesterol. So in that case, that's oftentimes a sign that someone needs to look at the thyroid as well. Because it really, thyroid is considered a risk factor for heart disease, both because of all the changes that go on with the heart rate and blood pressure, but also the blood fats, the cholesterol and the triglycerides as well. So these are all risk factors as well.
Well, you know, one of the most common maladies in medicine, and I know because I was an orthopedic surgeon for many years, but it's carpal tunnel syndrome. And one of the causes of carpal tunnel syndrome, which most doctors, and I'll have to admit, probably myself included, but even some of the finest doctors I know, I mean, some of the, my favorite neurologist, who's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant man, you know, but it's hypothyroidism. In fact, he told me that he'd actually missed it, I think, at his mother-in-law. I was very, very embarrassed because of it, but the hypothyroidism seems to contribute to this carpal tunnel syndrome. Have you run into that in your studies, Mary?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, it causes inflammation of the carpal nerve. It can also cause inflammation of the tarsal nerve. So people can also have something called tarsal tunnel syndrome, which is an inflammation and irritation that causes pain in the foot and the ankle, much like carpal tunnel causes pain in the wrist and the hands and the fingers. And it also contributes, hypothyroidism also contributes to a problem that causes pain in the foot called plantar fasciitis. So we see a variety of these neurological types of conditions that cause pain in the extremities that are linked to an underactive thyroid. So again, it's one of those things, if someone has carpal or tarsal tunnel or plantar fasciitis, they would definitely want to also have their thyroid evaluated to make sure that that was not either the cause of the problem or certainly a contributing factor that's aggravating it as well.
Well, how much of the hypothyroidism that we see today is related to the fact that an awful lot of people are iodine deficient because, of course, they've taken a lot of the iodine out of our milk and out of the of our bread, things they used to put. In fact, certainly only about half of our salt is iodized today. And at one time, of course, they were really emphasizing the importance of iodine in the diet. And for some reason, some strange reason, why the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. seem to be cutting back on the thyroid intake. Of course, we used to eat a lot of fish, but now we can't eat the fish because of the mercury. But what about the relationship between the hypothyroidism and the lack of iodine in our diet?
Well, this is a good question. It's also a controversial question because we have some different opinions with some different practitioners. There's, on the one hand, the general statistics are looking at iodine deficiency in the U.S., and they're finding that about 20 to 25% of the population is quantifiably deficient in iodine, which is up from 20 years ago when we had very few people that were deficient in iodine.
I think that's so vitally important, Mary. The thing is that, you know, in the past, why the public health authorities did everything to be sure we got adequate iodine, and now Mary's saying that 25% of our population is deficient in iodine. And, of course, we've talked about it in other contexts, but please pick up the story there.
Exactly. Well, and this iodine deficiency means that people are at higher risk of developing thyroid conditions, and it's especially dangerous for women who are thinking of getting pregnant or who are in pregnancy, because iodine is an essential building block for thyroid hormone, and the lack of it during pregnancy in particular can contribute to cognitive deficits in the unborn child. So we see a lot of interest in making sure that people are getting enough iodine, while at the same time people are avoiding salt because of their health. They're looking to stay away from processed foods and salty foods, which is where some of the iodine has been coming in, as well as the seafood and some of the seaweeds and things like that. On the other hand, if you are iodine sufficient and you have enough iodine in your system and you take extra iodine, this can be an aggravating factor that can actually worsen an autoimmune thyroid condition. It can cause inflammation in the thyroid. So the key with iodine is not being deficient and not getting too much. You want to have just the right amount. And so some of the doctors that I know that are concerned about the iodine deficiency issue in particular are now doing more testing for the iodine levels to really pinpoint those people who could benefit from iodine versus those people who don't need extra iodine and who in fact might actually find that their condition gets worse if they take too much extra iodine.
All right, well, that's something that is a little beyond probably our discussion here. Now, what are some of the other things as far as the thyroid that you've learned as you've studied it? What happened to your Hashimoto's disease, which, of course, is an autoimmune condition of the thyroid? Is that better? Have you been able to help that at all?
Absolutely. I've been able to, through a combination of both conventional and more holistic approaches, I've been able to get my thyroid condition under control. For the large majority of people with autoimmune thyroid disease, there really isn't a cure that would get rid of the autoimmune condition completely and restore your thyroid back to normal health. So for many of us, we do require supplemental thyroid medication for life. But what we can do is do things that help reduce our risk of developing other autoimmune diseases and to really resolve a lot of the extra symptoms. So in my case, my focus was on making sure that I really cleaned up my diet and avoiding pesticides, avoiding hormones in my food, and, you know, really limiting the amount of soy that I was eating. And when I did have soy, focusing on just very small amounts in the most natural forms, the way the Asians would eat it rather than the processed forms that have become so popular. And also just making sure that I had a good balance of rest, because it's particularly important for people with thyroid and autoimmune disease to get enough sleep, and to practice a good mind-body approach. A lot of people find that deep breathing or prayer or some form of stress reduction can be really essential to calming the immune system, and so that's been a particularly helpful component for me as well. And also making sure that you get proper exercise without overdoing it, and ensuring good nutrition and making sure I'm getting a good multivitamin and a variety of particular nutrients like B vitamins, selenium, and tyrosine that are especially important for thyroid and immune system function.
And, of course, really one of the great tragedies is today that the health of the American people is not good. And, of course, unfortunately, we have a lot of diseases, the chronic diseases that will create these chronic immune diseases. Have you looked at all into the mycoplasma, the other chlamydia or brucella, or some of these other chronic diseases that so many people seem to have contracted that tend to promote autoimmune responses?
Yes, and in fact, there's actually some crossover with these, because there's a lot of thinking now that thyroid, as well as some of the other autoimmune diseases, may be the result in some people or in a substantial percentage of people of an exposure to either a bacterial or a viral or a stealth type of pathogen. So, you know, there's some theories that have found that bacterial exposures, even certain foodborne bacteria like Yersinia, can trigger autoimmune problems, especially thyroid in some patients. We certainly know that exposure to the mononucleosis virus seems to be a trigger factor for some people who develop thyroid issues, as well as chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia types of symptoms. And the idea of the stealth pathogens, the mycoplasmas, and some of the same crossover with the Lyme disease types of pathogens, we're starting to see that these types of infections can create an autoimmune type of environment where people then are finding that they're developing other autoimmune conditions as a result of exposures to these types of pathogens. So some of the great doctors are doing work with antibiotic therapy, antiviral therapy. They're doing a lot of really interesting things, but mostly in the complementary and integrative fields.
All right, fine. Of course, we became interested in this. So you talk about soy, and so if you go to the Orient, why the people in Japan, in China have eaten soy for many, many years, but they don't eat it as a major component of their diet. There are certain condiments that they make up of very, very choice. You can see them in a Chinese restaurant, little tiny strips of this very soft, almost gelatinous type of a product there that they put in your Chinese soup and really adds the flavor to it, but they don't eat large amounts of soy like we do here in the United States. Would you like to perhaps talk a little bit about that, because I think it's such an important issue. Most people look to soy and they say, well, my goodness, the Chinese, the Orientals have eaten soy for years, so there can be no possible harm from it, but they don't tell us the rest of the story, so will you do that?
Exactly. Well, I think that the thing that we need to keep in mind is that the Asian diet, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Korean, a lot of the Asian diets that use soy, they use soy, as you mentioned, as a condiment, and they use it in conjunction with other types of foods. So if you think about, for example, a traditional bowl of miso soup that is popular in Japanese food, there may be a few small cubes of tofu floating in that miso soup, but it is not going to be a huge block of tofu. It's going to be just a small, maybe enough that would fit on a tablespoon, not much more than that. And that would be the soy in that dish. There's not going to be a huge quantity of soy. Or in a stir fry, there may be a few chunks of tempeh, but it's not going to be a huge quantity. And the other thing that the Asians typically do is they balance a lot of their soy with very iodine-rich food. And iodine seems to help the body absorb the soy more effectively. So there's actually some thinking that some of the additional thyroid risks in the United States of eating too much soy come particularly in people who are deficient in iodine, whereas the typical Asian diet is not iodine deficient. Here in America, unfortunately, I think we get the idea that if a little is good, more is even better. And so I've had women contact me that are...
Hold that thought for just a minute. We'll be back here in just a moment with Mary Shulman. Mary, go right on. You were just said you've had women contact you.
Yes, I've had women contact me who are just going soy crazy. They've decided that they think soy is the answer to all of their ills, and so they are having soy smoothies for breakfast and soy snacks and soy nuts and edamame beans, and they're having soy burgers and soy shakes and soy candy bars and soy, they're every processed form of soy they can find, whether it's a burger or an artificial meat product or shakes, candy bars, cookies, soy chips, every possible snack food and processed form of soy. And in some cases, within a couple of months of going on one of these soy crazy diets, these women are also starting to develop thyroid conditions. And so it's this American idea, if a little bit of soy is good, well, a whole lot must be better. And frankly, that when you start to take soy at those kinds of levels, you are transforming what in very small doses can be a healthy food into a drug. Because at high doses, soy does have drug properties. It has hormonal properties. So I think Americans need to realize that if we want to eat soy like the Asians, we need to use it very judiciously, and much like a condiment, and in its fermented natural form. So tofu, tempeh, miso, these are the ways to be drinking it. But a gallon of soy milk a day with soy powders, pills, proteins, and bars is not the way to use soy. It's not a healthy way, and it certainly is going to get us so exposed to the hormonal effects of soy that we really don't need.
And I think it's really, these are things that the average individual really doesn't understand. We know that an awful lot of men are having sexual dysfunction today, but nobody ever points out that a high soy diet exposes them to a high estrogen intake. Wouldn't that be, or at least an estrogen-like intake? Is that true?
Exactly. I mean, certainly I don't think any men out there want to be taking estrogen pills. But when they start doing heavy-duty, high quantities of overconsumption of soy, they might as well be taking estrogen pills because it will start to have an estrogenic effect on them. And, so it's an issue where people need to be very careful. They need to realize that while things may be natural, that doesn't necessarily argue for having them in large quantities. The other concern that we have is that a lot of the soy that we're getting in the United States right now is genetically modified as well. So the GMO soy products, these genetically modified soy, you know, we don't even know what that is going to be doing. And frankly, you know, I think that anyone who's eating soy needs to be especially careful to avoid the genetically modified products. And most companies that are using soy that is not will mark on their packaging, you know, no GMO soy or not genetically modified. And I think people ought to be really looking for that because, again, it's a question of I don't really want to be, you know, the test case for them to practice on and to see what happens when people eat genetically modified soy over a long period of time.
Well, you know, I think it's so interesting. I don't think the average American has any idea how prevalent the genetically modified foods are today or really what the scientific studies show because, of course, the very limited scientific studies done by the companies who produce these products, they wanted to get them on the market. But when the people have analyzed these studies, they found that really there are very, very profound impacts on many of the organ structures of the body. And then, of course, we know that certainly in some of these products, certainly fed to animals, the animals, of course, will not take them. The animals tend to get to either they won't eat them or they get very ill when they take large doses of genetically modified soy or corn and these other products. Genetically modified corn really produced dramatic infertility in the pigs. I wonder what it does in humans. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Mary Shulman. And am I pronouncing your name correctly? How would you pronounce it?
Shulman.
Shulman. All right, fine. And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Now, Mary had pointed out the danger of men consuming large doses of soy products. And there are a lot of people who said, well, this is a natural product, you know, it must be good. And they didn't understand this is a waste product. They had to figure some way of getting rid of it. And of course, it was a waste product. After extracting the soy oil from the soybean seeds. And so they came up and they decided they were going to feed it to the American people. Now, they could not feed this to animals because it created terrible problems with the animals when they got too much of this, and chickens especially. I mean, the chickens just had terrible problems, and so they're using this. The Americans, they have a massive propaganda campaign, and of course, when men get too much of this, they get very feminized because it has an estrogenic effect. But nobody is telling the men that, and then you wonder why so many men are having a sexual dysfunction today. And then Mary's bringing out the danger that so much of the soy is genetically engineered. Would you like to talk to our audience just a little bit about your concern about the genetic engineering of the soy? Because, of course, almost all the soy here, the way it's going, you know, you can have people who don't have genetically engineered seeds. But if the neighbor has it, why, by cross-pollination, increasingly all of our seeds are getting genetically modified, which is why Bill Gates and the elite are storing seeds up there. You know, off of Finland in a underground cave there on an island, and they know that they're destroying the food supplies of America and really the whole world. But they don't want the American people to know that. So they're preparing the seeds so that they'll be there for them. But what about us right now? As they're, I believe they're doing terrible damage. What are your thoughts?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, people need to be much more aware of the overall issue of genetically modified foods, and in particular the prevalence of the genetically modified soy foods, because as you said, you know, there really is a tremendous drive to push this as a food product in America. I mean, we've been sold a lot of misinformation, as far as I'm concerned, about the health benefits of soy. And, you know, really, every study that I see keeps coming back to the fact that really the only benefit of soy, and again, in very small amounts when used like the Asians, is as a substitute for meat proteins, because occasionally it can help lower cholesterol and serve as a healthy substitute for higher fat, higher calorie meats. But it doesn't help with menopausal symptoms. There's no evidence, and they haven't proven any, you know, side benefits there. And it doesn't really help with any of the other hormonal benefits that have been claimed for it. And So really, I mean, there's not a lot of reason for us to be eating the kind of quantities of soy that we're that are being sold to people. And, you know, frankly, I've talked with a lot of doctors that are doing hormonal medicine, and they are suggesting that women who have any history or risk of breast cancer in their families really stay away from soy for the most part, and that women who are dealing with trying to get pregnant or who may have had fertility problems should also eliminate soy from their diet. And again, certainly people with thyroid conditions people who are at risk of autoimmune may want to consider cutting out all forms of soy, or at least the genetically modified forms of soy and processed soy, because processed soy, there really is no reason at all to process soy foods and try to eat them, because that takes any of the possible benefits away anyway. So really, again, it goes back to utilizing it the way the Asians do, in the most natural form, in a very limited component of our diet, not in every food product like we seem to see, you know, if we go around the supermarket these days.
And I think it's amazing, you know, when you begin to study this, you find that some of these soy products they use over in Asia, it will take them a year to produce it. They will ferment it for a year, and because that makes it much more digestible and changes the structure of this, so it will not have the deleterious effects. Well, let's go to Kathy, who's calling from Oregon. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIPIDY. 1-888-24-LIPIDY or 464-8295. Kathy, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yeah, I did. I had a comment and a question.
All right, go ahead. Speak up a little bit, please.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Okay, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Go right ahead. I'll at least get your question out.
I was one of those folks that had a terrible allergic reaction to soy. I thought, oh, menopause, I was just taking everything, just like Mary was saying. And I got a terrible allergic reaction under my armpits. And for about 2 months, I was just miserable. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And I had a dream one night that it was soy. That word soy just came into my dream. And so I contacted a naturopath, and we kind of went down that road, and she said, oh, yes, it's very highly allergenic. So
hold that thought.
I got after that.
Hold that thought. We'll be back. You hang right up. We'll get back to you in just a moment.
Okay.
This is Dr. Stan, and give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and we've got Kathy calling from Oregon. And Kathy, go right ahead. Did you have a question or anything
else
you wanted to say?
So then I haven't been taking soy, but it's kind of recommended to me that soy lecithin was okay to take, so I've been having some of that. So I wanted to ask Mary what her comments would be on soy lecithin.
Well, I think that it's definitely in any, you know, in moderation, and if it's coming from a non genetically modified source, a small amount of soy lecithin shouldn't be a problem for people. But it's one of those things where if you've had an allergy to other forms of soy or a sensitivity, you have to be especially careful and really monitor your symptoms. What you might want to do is really kind of do a trial and really keep a food diary and monitor symptoms. A lot of us think that a sensitivity is going to manifest like within a few minutes of eating something, but sometimes within a day or even, you know, 24 to 36 hours after you've eaten something, you'll have an onset of fatigue or you'll feel achy in the joints, and these are signs that you may have a sensitivity to the food item. So especially with soy, because it's got such a high risk of sensitivity in so many people, you want to pay particular attention to any unusual symptoms in the couple of days after you've eaten it.
Right. Well, I've been noticing I'm kind of having hot flashes, and I'm thinking, I wonder why I'm having hot flashes. And that could be the lecithin.
Yeah, that very well could be, because, again, it's having a hormonal effect, and it may be that it's triggering an imbalance in your hormones.
Right. What exactly is soy lecithin?
Well, it's a byproduct of soy that's been mixed in with another binder, I believe. So I'm not completely up on all of the specifics, but I know it's a processed form of soy. So it's, again, not an ideal form of soy. If you're going to be using any kind of soy products, again, my recommendation is always to go to the most natural Asian-style forms.
Okay. Right. Well, I'm really glad for this conversation tonight.
Well, that's why we do what we do 5 hours a day.
Right. Yeah,
because
right.
We try to get things. Go ahead.
I try to tell people about it, and they just, you know, they're just so sure that they're right, and I don't know what I'm talking about. But so this program, I'm gonna copy this program and send it to some people. I've been trying to tell this because maybe they'll listen to the professionals.
Well, but basically, maybe they'll listen to this and they don't want to get listening to something else. Because I'll tell you, people had better start listening not only to this, but all the other things we're talking about. Because the health of the American people is really falling. And our children, we've got somewhere between 1 and 2 million children with autism. We're destroying the lives and the health of our children. We'll be right back here.
Oh, we are.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course we have Kathy calling in from Oregon. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. 464-8295. Our guest is Mary Shulman, and we're talking about the thyroid. We're talking about the deleterious effects of soy products, large amounts of it on the thyroid. Kathy, did you have anything else to say before we let you go?
No, I just had one other quick comment. You were talking about GMO. I was just reading here now. When you go to the store and you get the fruits and vegetables, you have those little round stickers on them. Well, if you have a four-digit number on that sticker, it's conventionally grown. If you have a five-digit number starting with 9, it's organic. And if you have a five-digit number starting with 8, it's GMO.
All right, fine. Thank you for sharing that with us. I wasn't aware of that. Anyway, I think that we're going to have to, and they should not be allowing GMO foods in this country. The Europeans won't allow it, but the people here who are here to protect our health, because they're from the government. They're the same people, of course, in New Orleans wouldn't let anybody in to rescue the people who were dying in the there during the flood. But anyway, thanks so much, Kathy.
Okay, well, thank you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Mary, do you have a website, telephone number, or anything you'd like to get out?
Yes, I do. I have a website that people can take a look at. It's www.thyroid-info.com. That's thyroid-info.com. And I have my contact information, my email, my phone number, and free newsletters on thyroid disease that people can sign up for. So there's a lot of good information for folks available on the site.
Well, do you think that the incidence of thyroid disease is increasing in America? It's increased over the last 20, 25 years?
I think it's definitely on the rise. You know, there's some argument that, oh, maybe it's better detection, maybe we're just finding more cases because we're looking for them better, but I honestly think that there is a higher rate of thyroid problems, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think, number one, we've got a lot of people who are having a lot more exposure to radiation, and radiation exposure is a known risk factor for thyroid issues. We've got a lot more exposure to pesticides, and pesticides in the food, pesticides in the air, in the water supply, and we know that pesticides can be a trigger and a risk factor for thyroid issues. We also have a lot of people, unfortunately, that are current or former smokers, cigarette smokers, and cigarettes are just, you know, we know a lot of the problems about lung disease, but we don't know that smoking is a serious risk factor for thyroid problems as well. So we've got a lot of increase in that respect. And then, of course, we have this increasing overconsumption of soy, along with this increasing problem with iodine deficiency. And then I think there's also issues of more and more worsening of the diet, in that more people are eating white flour, white sugar, inflammatory kinds of foods, which then contribute to the overall climate to predispose people towards autoimmune diseases as well.
Well, now, what about the water fluoridation, putting fluoride in, because fluoride is the same family, the periodic table, as iodine, and some people say that the iodine competes the fluoride competes with the iodine for getting into the thyroid, and simply the thyroid can't get in there, and fluoride can create problems as far as the thyroid. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
Absolutely. In fact, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because fluoride is yet another one of the factors that we look at as a possible contributor to the increase of thyroid conditions. In particular, one of the things that people don't realize is that fluoride was until, you know, maybe 30 or 40 years ago used as a drug to treat an overactive thyroid condition. So it was considered, before we developed some of the more modern anti-thyroid drugs, fluoride was one of the drugs that doctors would use to slow the thyroid down. And now, because fluoride is basically a waste product that is available and would require, you know, sort of toxic disposal, it's now turned around and has ended up in our water supply. And, you know, there's a lot of question as to whether or not it actually has any benefits for, from a dental health standpoint, but we definitely know that overexposure to fluoride taken internally can act as an anti-thyroid agent, so it can actually slow the thyroid down and contribute to hypothyroidism in some people. So it's one of the things that when people are really struggling with a thyroid condition, we also tell them to stay away from fluoridated water and to avoid any kind of ingested fluoride. They can use some external fluoride treatments like toothpaste and such, but we really want to try to get them away from taking fluoride internally, and in particular fluoridated water.
All right, and unfortunately, about 68% of our water supply in the United States is fluoridated by the government that's here to help, and I really believe that they're fudging the figures. They know how dangerous it is. They will not allow fluoride in the water over in Europe, but it's all right over here. So either they're wrong or our leaders are in the process of poisoning us. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and Mary, you sounds like you spend an awful lot of time researching, studying this. You are extremely articulate when it comes to discussing the subject.
Oh, thank you. I really feel like it's part of my mission here is to really make sure that people are aware about thyroid disease and the different factors that are out there that are actually contributing to our risks and adding to the difficulty in getting it diagnosed, because we have so many people that are suffering with this, and it's very frustrating to me because it's not an easily diagnosed and in some cases not even easily treated condition. It's the symptoms can be vague, they're very often overlooked, people are stuck in HMOs and insurance situations where they're being rushed through very quickly and they're not even getting the proper tests to really evaluate for this problem. And for people who are suffering with an undiagnosed and untreated thyroid condition, it really is condemning them to a life of ill health. So I feel if I can help just even a handful of people avoid that kind of a situation, then, you know, I'm doing my job.
Well, certainly the thing is that it's, Mary has said, you know, it's estimated that almost a quarter of the population may be actually hypothyroid. But, you know, unless somebody calls the attention of the doctor to it, he's not going to do the special thyroid test. And yet, these should be done probably routinely when they do a large panel, when you go to see your doctor once a year or so. And then, of course, how effective is the thyroid that they give us? And is there any difference in the thyroid? I know the traditional thyroid that when I was practicing medicine was the armor thyroid. It was made from the thyroid of certain cattle, things of that sort. Are there any differences in the thyroid, the type of thyroid, and is there any autoimmune disease or allergic reaction to animal thyroid?
Well, right now we have really several types of thyroid available. The main type that a lot of doctors are using conventionally is the synthetic thyroid medicine, or levothyroxine or L-thyroxine, and that would be, you know, brand names people would recognize would be Synthroid or Levoxyl or Levothyroid. And this is what the vast majority of doctors are using, and it works for some patients, but some people find that it doesn't resolve all of their symptoms because it's only providing one of the hormones in a synthetic form that the body is used to. The thyroid produces two key hormones as well as a variety of other hormones and cofactors, and the synthetic thyroxine is just one hormone. Now, the natural thyroid, like the armor thyroid that you're talking about, currently it's produced from the dried thyroid gland of pigs, and this drug actually includes a variety of different hormones that some people believe are more similar in some ways to the way the human thyroid operates. So some of the holistic and integrative practitioners prefer to use the animal thyroid. There's a little bit of a debate over whether or not it may actually increase antigens, or it may trigger autoimmunity in some people, but the vast majority of holistic doctors that I know that are using it don't seem to have any concerns about it. Some patients prefer it. Some find they do better with it. It's a matter of a lot of contention, though, because I think the traditional medical world would like to eliminate all of the options and pretty much limit patients solely to the synthetic thyroxin. If they had their will, wishes, they would probably get rid of Armour Thyroid completely and prevent patients from being able to get it at all.
Well, now, is that because the synthyroid is more expensive than the Armour? Because, you know, as a matter of fact, my physician, is a good doctor, a good friend, has put me on the synthyroid. I don't think I've ever been on the Armour type, but I know that was what was used when I was practicing. I said, but doctors today, unfortunately, are the victims of the meetings. We're required to go to meetings on a regular basis. But those meetings, of course, were being conditioned, promoted by the drug companies. You've got to use our product because it's any better than the others. And so we have to get, 25, 30 hours of these meetings every year. But so many of them are used to actually push certain pharmaceutical products. And I always suspected that a lot of those doctors are getting big bucks to come and lecture about why, of course, and not their product, but the product that they're being paid to push, and the doctors are going along with it. Do you know, what's the difference in cost between the synthyroid and the Armour Thyroid?
Well, you hit the nail right on the head there, because the synthroid typically runs, a typical dosage for an average patient would cost about, if you bought it on the open market, would be about $30 to $35 a month, and the typical cost for Armour Thyroid would be about $8 a month. And so the synthroid is much more expensive. And the company that owns the manufacturing right now, which is Abbott Laboratories, is one of the biggest labs in the United States, one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world, really. And Abbott Laboratories funds a lot of medical school programs. They fund a lot of endocrinology programs. And they have armies of sales representatives armed with brochures and free samples and materials and office items and posters and pens and script pads and everything you can imagine to hand out to these doctors and their staff. And the folks selling Armour Thyroid, it's a couple thousand, prescriptions a month, really, compared to what they're doing in terms of the synthroid. So they don't have any marketing staff and budget to be, reaching out and holding meetings and golf tournaments and that type of thing. So it's really, you got a juggernaut, a marketing juggernaut that is really pushing everything else out of the marketplace by virtue of the fact that it's really monopolized medical education, and it monopolizes the doctors.
And, of course, unfortunately, many times government officials will recommend things or certainly outlaw other products because, again, the FDA is actually being funded by the drug companies, but that's a whole different story. But, actually, when the drug companies are giving massive, I'm work counting, hundreds of millions of dollars to the Federal Drug Administration, a lot of the money, the funding for this federal agency comes from the drug companies. Some people, some suspicious, paranoid people might think that the people who are paying for the party are calling the tune.
Exactly, and you also have a revolving door in and out of the FDA, back and forth between staff people to drug companies.
Right.
So it's hard to feel that the FDA is truly an impartial observer in all of this, or that its concerns are primarily the patients and the outcomes and how patients are feeling. And in particular, we also see this with the various medical groups that are organizing around thyroid issues, because they tend to get a lot of funding from the drug company that makes the synthetic thyroid medicine. And so it's no surprise that these same organizations turn around and consistently recommend and represent and defend the synthetic, and really would like to see the natural drugs taken off the market entirely to avoid that competition.
Well, as far as you're concerned, you see nothing wrong with the Armour Thyroid then?
No, I think the best thyroid medicine for each patient is the one that works best safely for them. And my frustration is that a lot of doctors don't even make patients aware that there are options. So I think people should be aware of the fact that there are options and allowed to try them if the things they're doing aren't working for them. But that's where I end up departing from the conventional wisdom, because most doctors would disagree with me and say that people should be on one drug and that's the only option they should be given. And if they don't feel well on it, then they probably need some Prozac.
Well, and of course, Prozac is primarily fluoride-based. You know, it's a fluoride medication, and that fluoride has a profound impact on the brain.
Exactly.
This is drinking your fluoridated water, but they're not going to tell the American people that. That it was actually Adolf Hitler used the fluoride, the water in the concentration camps. It kept the people in line. Well, our guest today, of course, is Mary Shulman, and we're talking about the thyroid problems. If you're out there, you have a question, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And, of course, I think the other issue, of course, is the issue of soy, because soy seems to have an effect of depressing the thyroid. Do we have any idea why that takes place, Mary?
Well, we think that the soy actually binds to the thyroid receptors and prevents the thyroid hormone itself from attaching to the receptors in some cases. And then we also know that as an allergen and as an irritant, it can aggravate the immune system, which then causes the autoimmune antibodies to be produced that then start to attack the thyroid. So it's kind of two different separate mechanisms that both can affect the thyroid in a negative way.
All right. Do you have any idea why you developed the Hashimoto's disease, which for our listeners is an autoimmune disease of the thyroid?
Well, in my case, I think it was a combination of several things. Number one, I was, sad to say, a smoker for a lot of my 20s, and so probably a good 10 years where I was a cigarette smoker. And as I mentioned earlier, cigarette smoking is definitely a very risky factor for thyroid conditions. I also really was not taking care of myself in terms of diet and rest. So I was working a lot of hours. I wasn't eating properly, and I was living on a lot of caffeine and nicotine. And so I think what happened was I put myself into a situation of adrenal fatigue. So I really ran down my engine. And when your adrenals are not functioning properly, because they're part of the endocrine system, it forces the thyroid and the stress hormones to kind of have to kick in. And in this case, the thyroid was simply, I think, unable to carry the load. And so the combination of the constant stress, both physical and work stress, and then not eating properly, not giving my body nutrition, and then adding the damage of the cigarette smoking into the situation were probably the factors in my case that triggered my thyroid condition.
All right, fine. Well, I think that the difficulty is there are an awful lot of people out there who are hypothyroid who do not understand or do not realize it. And, you know, unless, of course, something calls the attention to it, why, of course, it's not going to be tested for it. It's a very, very simple thing to treat with, of course, low dose of medication, whether it be synthyroid or armor thyroid. And yet, of course, so many people, of course, suffering from this malady. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment, and we're actually going to put together a 4-tape set on soy. We think it's an important product. We do carry an excellent book, which is called The Whole Soy Story. Are you acquainted with that book, Mary?
Yeah, I think I've heard good things about it.
All right, fine. Well, we'll be telling our listeners just a little bit more about that in just a moment. We just have a short break here, and then we'll wrap up the program. Mary, just stay with us, and we'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty to wrap up the program for today. Well, Mary, you have got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What message would you like to leave with our listeners out across America?
Well, I think the message I'd like to leave with people is that, number one, if they are experiencing vague and unidentifiable symptoms, things like fatigue, unexplained weight gain or difficulty losing weight, brain foggy, fuzziness, low sex drive, feeling cold, puffy, tired, achy, carpal tunnel, sleep apnea, snoring, these kinds of symptoms that sometimes, you know, don't look at them as a bigger picture, that they really ought to think thyroid, because there are so many of us walking around with thyroid conditions that are not diagnosed. And so I'd love for people to be aware that they're not getting thyroid tests as part of their normal physicals. It's not part of a normal blood panel. You have to ask your doctor specifically to look at your thyroid, to feel it, to check it, to give you the blood test. because I think a lot of folks are suffering some of these vague symptoms, and they think it's age or it's lifestyle, and they don't realize that they may actually be able to get properly diagnosed and treated, and that could be life-changing for people's health.
How do you actually make the diagnosis of Hashimoto's? I mean, is it simply do people have a goiter? Is there a blood test for it? Do they have to do a biopsy? How do they make the diagnosis of Hashimoto's? Remember, I graduated from medical school 55 years ago, so I've forgotten a lot of these things.
Sure. Well, they actually have a very good blood test for antibodies now that can detect Hashimoto's disease in the vast majority of people who have it will test positive for these Hashimoto's antibodies. So it's fairly easy to pick up. In some people, if they have a nodules or lumps, they can actually identify it through lumpy thyroid as well will sometimes be a trigger. But most of the time, the diagnosis is made by a doctor running the blood work. They run an autoimmune thyroid panel, and they're able to pick up on the Hashimoto's disease fairly clearly using that blood test.
All right, fine. Well, things have certainly changed a lot since I went to medical school, but it still is a great and noble profession. I envy the young people that are still entering the field, even though with what the government is doing and the new regulations and the promise that, oh, my goodness, everybody's going to have medical care, but what they don't tell you is that they're going to ration access to health care, and I think it'll be increasingly difficult to get these blood tests, especially if you get to be older and the whole theme seems to be somehow to, well, if we could just restrict the care to the Medicare patients, might there be a lot more available for everybody else. So I think we're in for some very interesting times. Mary, I want to thank you so very much for being with us, and I do hope we can get you onto one of our other programs. In fact, we have three other networks we're on. I'd love to have you there.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we wrap up our program. We are going to put together a four-tape set on soy because we've had four excellent interviews on this subject. We do carry the book, The Whole Soy Story, and we recommend it. We have this on hand right now, The Whole Soy Story, giving the whole background of the problems with eating soy. And I never thought I would read a book on soy that would be fascinating, but I will have to admit this one was done so well, The Whole Soy Story, that we read it and learned so much about the condiments and about the miso and the tofu and all of these things. So it's an excellent source of information. We carry a book by Marcia Angel. She was actually the editor of the New England Journal of America, New England Journal of Medicine, the most prestigious of all the medical journals. She's a professor at Harvard. She wrote about the FDA and how it is, of course, betraying the American people and doing so much harm. The title of the book, What You Should Know About, The Truth About the Drug Companies. That's The Truth About the Drug Companies by Marshall Angel. And let me recommend these books. We carry them because we want you to have them. There are all sorts of terrible new diseases that are afflicting the American people. And I believe many of these have been produced in laboratories. And if you doubt that, we have pages. We can send you the pages from Zygmunt Brzezinski's book he wrote back in 1970. He is the man, of course, is the man who created the Trilateral Commission. He certainly was the advisor to President Carter and did all the terrible things that happened at the Carter administration, but don't feel bad. He was the advisor, foreign policy advisor to Barack Obama. I think he's the one who picked Barack Obama to become the President of the United States. But back in 1970, he was talking about how we'd be able to create these terrible new chronic diseases. Well, we've created them. As incredible as it seems, and we can send you the pages of the book. Book is very difficult to get on Amazon today. I wonder why. Maybe they don't want you to know. Well, anyway, we've got a great DVD. It's called Terrible New Diseases. It's a talk given by Dr. Garth Nicholson, certainly one of the most outstanding physicians and researchers in our country, held teaching positions at MD Anderson Clinic until they killed his boss with sick bullets in the back of his head, and Garth and his wife were they attempted to kill them a number of times. We carry his book, the name escapes me now, but you can always get his book. But we certainly have his DVD called Terrible New Diseases, and then the book is called Daylily. It's Daylily, I believe it's Operation Daylily, but it goes in the background of how they created these diseases. And then, of course, we hope that you'll want to get some of the other items. We have a four-tape set on Lyme disease, which is another genetically created disease. Why would anybody want to do that? Ladies and gentlemen, we have evil people out there. Why are we fighting in Afghanistan? Why have we killed all those people in Afghanistan and Iraq? I mean, we didn't have to go over there because we haven't been told the truth about what happened on September 11th, if you doubt that. I mean, we've had a number of people we've actually interviewed who are actually living in hiding today because of what they wrote about 9/11. Why would they try to kill? They kill Mike Rupert and try to poison him, and he's living in, you know, in hiding in Canada. Jimmy Walters, who we interviewed, a multimillionaire, is living in hiding in the Europe because of what he wrote about what happened on September 11th. So we really haven't been told the truth about what happened then or why we're fighting over in Iraq today, where we probably killed close to 1 million people. But then we never talk about the 2 million people we killed in South Vietnam. We talk about 58,000 boys who died there. We never tell you that all during that time we were fighting over there, we were funding the Russians, we were funding the North Vietnamese, we were funding the Viet Cong, who were killing our boys. Just as today we're funding the Pakistani government that's funding the Taliban that are killing our boys. You need to get my pamphlet on the Communist-Capitalist Alliance. The Communist-Capitalist Alliance goes into the funding.